The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions? Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and I'm here with Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. Each week with my global roster of fund managers, analysts, and journalists in major financial centers and on the ground, I'll be examining emerging and frontier markets, investing in them, try to clear up some of the misconceptions about them, and suggest courses of action for you, the listener. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure I can spot the differences between promising investments and ones that are maybe less promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And today we'll be having a look at Brazil, but the category of emerging markets also includes such major countries as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, the Czech Republic, and several Asian countries, including Thailand. And we'll have reports on Thailand and Turkey, which we did last week, Thailand this week, to enable you to see what impact the crisis in Thailand might have on your thinking about that country. Frontier markets are generally the less developed emerging markets, although it does include some wealthy countries such as the ones in the Gulf, but it's mainly countries such as Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Panama, Slovenia, and Botswana. This category also includes the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and we'll be having a look today at a fund that invests through an index in these countries. I'll also be going to Dubai for another look at its success in getting the nomination for Expo 2020. Our first guest is here to talk with us about a major sporting event taking place very soon. And it's not the Winter Olympics in Russia at Sochi, which is running from February the 6th to the 23rd. It's actually Brazil, which, of course, will be holding the World Cup. That's World Cup of Soccer for our North American listeners from June the 12th to July 13th of this year. And then, of course, the Summer Olympics 2 years later. So we're going to go have a look at its preparations and what possible impact they might have on investments there with Daniela Blackhouse, an economist at the Bank of Nova Scotia. I have her on the line from Toronto. And welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Daniela.
Thank you, Gavin, for having me again.
Not at all. So, before we drill down to look at Brazil's preparations for the World Cup, which is, good heavens, less than 6 months away now, could you give us a brief view of the economy as it stands right now? Because obviously it had a fairly major slowdown in 2012, which continued to some degree last year as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think that Brazil right now is a very interesting story. I think what we've seen in the last 2 years, it has disappointed in terms of growth, as you were mentioning. In 2012, Brazil grew only 1%, and we are expecting that last year they grew 2.3%, around that number. In the future, we don't see Brazil growing at faster rates than at least below 3%, between 2.5, 2.8 in the coming 2 years. So I think that the growth story in Brazil is different from the one that we heard maybe 10 years ago. In terms of inflation, we've seen that inflation remains persistently high. It's closer to the upper limit of the central bank tolerance range, which is 6.5%. So inflation remains high. This has prompted the authorities to increase reference rates. They have, in the last 12 months, or less than a year, they've increased the reference rate by more than 300 basis points. So when we see the rest of Latin America cutting rates in some countries, we see Brazil hiking rates to try to contain inflationary pressures. Also, we saw the last year that the currency was getting very, very strong. So the central bank, again, authorities intervened the currency market to avoid further appreciation of the currency against the U.S. dollar. This was trying to at least get better the export sector that we saw, again, a very weak performance. And then by the end of last year, we saw, again, intervention of the central bank, but in the opposite direction, to try to avoid further depreciation of the currency. So we had last year as well social protests, demonstrations. This year is very interesting. We have the elections, the World Cup, Olympic Games. So I think it's a very complex but very interesting story right now for Brazil.
Now, well, you mentioned the currency, which, as you noted, had been really strong and had led to the authorities intervening to try to restrain its strength because it was hurting exports. And then once the U.S. Federal Reserve started talking about tapering in May last year, the Brazilian real, along with a large number of other emerging market currencies, started sliding. Supporting it is estimated to have been fairly costly for the government. There was a blog, I think, in the Financial Times a few days ago, which was talking about numbers like $75 billion plus to support the real. Is that number in the ballpark in terms of accuracy? And do you feel it's likely to have to continue to support? Or will the increase in interest rates help maybe stop the slide in the real?
Well, I think that central bank intervention is there to stay. I don't think that, well, the currency, as you were mentioning, was very strong at the beginning of last year. They were talking a lot about that the Fed maintained the rate so low that, and Brazil having like a significant spread, that a lot of inflows were going to Brazilian assets. But then we saw that the authorities made a lot of effort to try to avoid further appreciation of the currency. And then we saw that opposite direction. We saw a weaker currency, which is helping exporters, and that will help the industry sector, which was hit significantly higher than other sectors of the economy. So yes, we think that the intervention will remain a norm in Brazil. We see the currency weakening further this year. The Fed policy is one of the factors, but I don't think it's the only factor that has affected the currency. Also, local dynamics of the economy, the intervention policy, higher rates, some loss of confidence in terms of government spending getting higher. So I think there's a lot of factors that have been weighing on the Brazilian real, not only the Fed, which I think it's part of the scenario and part of the whole dynamics of the region and for emerging markets. But for sure, also local factors affecting the currency.
And obviously, a couple of those local factors are the preparations for the World Cup in particular, because it is less than 6 months to go. Later in the program, we're going to hear about how Dubai is preparing for Expo 2020, which it won at the end of last year. Looking at Brazil's preparations for the World Cup, there's been a fair amount of concern about how finished or not some of the stadiums for the World Cup are. Some of the social protests last year were about apparently the diversion of resources to these prestige sporting projects such as the World Cup and the Olympics. Where exactly are we as far as Brazil's preparations, and do you feel that they will get it done on time? In the meantime, is that leading to some diversion of resources away from other areas and affecting the markets in general?
One thing is that, for sure, government spending has increased. And on an electoral year, that takes more. Normally, government spending tends to increase on a year with elections. Yeah, investment in stadiums for the World Cup, they remain subject of delays, and deadlines have been postponed. That's for sure. In terms of if they will finish the stadiums or not, so far what we heard from the government is that they will finish the stadiums and they will be done for the World Cup. But I think that the most interesting thing is to look at the broad picture in terms of infrastructure in Brazil. So it's not only the World Cup, but it's, and it's not only the stadiums, but other projects such as railways, public transport, airports, ports. And it's not only the stadiums, but other projects that I think, and that was part of the demonstrations and social protests that we saw last year. It was because of poor public transport in many of the big cities or small yep. cities. So far beyond from the stadiums, it's also other part of the infrastructure that we haven't seen a significant improvement that could help also other social programs that could help public, right? So it's yep. more that even though the stadiums could be finished, even though they could be at a higher cost, that's for sure, they will also are lagging in terms of other infrastructure that could have helped for the World Cup. And for sure, I think that for the Olympics, this could also mean another opportunity, right?
Absolutely. So with the Olympics coming up a couple of years after the World Cup, if the infrastructure projects you mentioned, like transportation in particular, have not been finished or have not had enough money sort of spent on them for the World Cup, then there's still the opportunity to do so in the next couple of years. But would that necessarily have an effect on the Brazil's credit profile? Because obviously, I presume most of this will be government spending. There isn't a great deal of private money in terms of joint ventures or public-private partnerships. This is very largely government spending. Am I correct?
Well, I think that the government will try to increase this private sector or get more involved, the private sector, on this type of project. The big mm-hmm. difference is that for the World Cup, you see in many different cities of Brazil, while the Olympics is mainly in Rio. So yep. it's different structure and different plans. Obviously, the Olympics mean way more people than that is going to go to Rio than for the World Cup. And the World Cup has a very important significance for not only Brazil, but also for the region, right? So it's yep. Different projects. But I think that the government will try to, again, learn from this experience and try to improve. And that would set it's a good opportunity for Brazil to take this as a new chance for that year. And another key point is that you won't have elections on the Olympic Games. So that's a totally different scenario than the one that we're seeing right now.
So to finish up here, Daniela, then which sectors look likely to be adversely affected or to benefit from what's happening in terms of the lag in infrastructure spending? Would infrastructure be an area that investors ought to be looking at on a two-year view with the World Cup coming up? Are there other ones like consumer spending that might benefit from the influx of visitors that Brazil's going to have?
I think we need to keep something in our head, that is that Brazil is a huge economy. It's a very yep. industrialized country. It's the seventh country and the seventh biggest economy in the world. So that means a lot of people, a lot of consumption. And this is not only a negative story for Brazil, but it also has positive things, mainly that it's like 200 million people in Brazil.
Yep.
So
yep.
Investors, I think, that will need to see some kind of commitment from the government to provide a better or a friendlier environment for investment. So I think that's a key point so we can start looking at a better situation for investment, which remains, in terms, if you compare it with other countries in the region, remains low as a percentage of GDP. So okay. I think there is door open for trying to improve this type of investors and investments. And as you were saying, they're huge projects which mean a lot of money, and I think that's a good thing. The main sectors, again, I think in terms of big projects, highways, subways, all kind of public transport, especially because the society is asking for that. So I think that's a gap in terms of infrastructure that could be closed in the coming years. But again, those are very long, medium-term projects that should take into account for policymakers.
Okay. Well, thanks very much indeed, Daniela. I do appreciate your insight on those.
Thank you.
Thanks. Our thanks to Daniela Bankhouse at the Bank of Nova Scotia in Toronto for that look at what we might expect in terms of investment and also, obviously, for the economy and the outlook as far as social progress as well from the two major sporting events upcoming in Brazil. Just before we go to the break, have you ever wondered what a newscaster means by the phrase a certain company has beat the index or outperformed the index? We can help you understand some of those terms because we're launching our new publication called the EFMI Newsletter, short for Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, and we can help explain what some of those investment phrases mean, why they're important, and we would like to provide you with our free introductory edition, which is due out in the next 10 days or so. Please write to us at info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. Now, we'll go to the break and come back with more information, this time on the Baltic economies. Thank you very much.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Understandably, investors place a lot of attention on the traditional emerging markets, particularly the big ones such as Brazil, which we were just discussing, and the other BRICS, Russia, India, and China, as well as some of the better-known frontier markets such as the United Arab Emirates or Nigeria. This means that smaller countries which have excellent prospects for longer-term investors may be overlooked. One means of addressing this is to actually get a good regional fund that looks at some of those smaller countries. The one we're going to talk about now is the DMS Baltic Index Fund, which is based on the NASDAQ OMX Baltic Benchmark Index, which comprises the stock exchange of the three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Obviously, the OMX Baltic Benchmark Index consists of the larger and more actively traded companies. And I have the Chief Executive Officer of DMS Funds, Peter Curley, on the line from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. He's also been a financial advisor and wealth manager. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, Peter. First of all, could you start off by explaining to our listeners the basic structure of the fund? How does the index work? What percentage do the various countries have in it? And how many stocks does it have?
Okay. We're talking about the OMX BBGI?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. The index was actually created by the NASDAQ.
Right.
And because those stock markets are actually owned by the NASDAQ. So they created the index. And it was based on that index that we launched the mutual fund. So it basically tracks that index. And it contains 30 stocks.
Right.
of the largest, most highly capitalized stocks traded on the ETH. They each have a stock exchange in Tallinn, in Riga, and Vilnius, but they all report to one and have one index. Right. So it's the top 30 stocks in those traded on those exchanges.
And how long has the index been going?
Well, the index actually can be tracked back for 10 years. So historical averages have been very good.
What have the returns been?
The returns have averaged around 12% a year. That's been the average. Of course, in 2008, 2009, they had very, very bad years. But otherwise, last year, the return was 14%.
That's very respectable indeed, and a 12% compound return over the last 10 years compares very favorably with actually the developed markets and a lot of the major emerging markets. So that's a good reason for investors to actually be looking at it. What are the underlying reasons for that excellent performance? I presume it's partially to do with the advent of capitalist economies and the fact that they're exposed to the European economy and have been providing useful services to those larger European countries.
Right. It was interesting. I visited Lithuania back in September. They wanted me to come up there and visit them, which I did. And what I was struck by is the speed at which things are done over there. It's as if everybody in that country has a sense of purpose. They know where they're going. They know where they came from. And they certainly don't want to slide back that way. And so what they were trying to do is they're trying to make their mark on the world economy. And, in 2008, they didn't take a dime from the European Central Bank. They decided to tighten their belts, and they had a severe contraction of approximately 21%. Their GDP... sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, Peter, that's a 21% contraction in GDP.
Yes.
That's astonishing. Yes. But they chose to go that route rather than, as you say, take any aid from the European Central Bank.
Correct. And their GDP growth is around 4% right now. And they're very proud of that. They're very proud of that. And, and I say this to everybody I meet. I have a feeling that they understand capitalism a little bit better than we do right now. And... it's the truth, and they want to do whatever they can to be accepted, and obviously they're part of the EU, which helps them. So they're doing really well.
Do they belong to the Eurozone as well, or do they still retain their own currencies?
Well, Lithuania right now is the only one of the three that remains with their own currency. And I believe it was Latvia went first with the euro, then Estonia just joined the euro. And I think that Lithuania still has the Litos, but they are going to be going to the euro next year in 2015. But the exchange is traded in euros. So they're in euros.
Yep. So effectively, it's they're lower cost producers, providers of services within the EU, two of them within the Eurozone and one soon to be.
Correct.
And therefore, it makes an attractive story, rather like some larger East European economies, which have been big beneficiaries of being part of the European Union and its trading system.
Correct, with the exception of Poland. Poland eked out a positive GDP in 2008. Which was really surprising, at 1.4%. But the caution here, the caveat is that it's a frontier market. I mean, the market total market capitalization of the stock market is approximately $4 billion. So any investing has to be looked at as long term.
And that would be at least 5 years in your view?
Yes, because of liquidity issues. The typical frontier market. But the fact of its proximity to the rest of the larger EU nations is what makes it very attractive.
And so, would you say that it is likely to, obviously making forecasts about future returns is one of the most useless things one can do as an investor. Right. But given its its excellent longer-term 10-year track record, given its small, well-educated population, and as you say, that sort of rigorous attitude towards capitalism, would you think it might actually compare favorably with other East European former communist bloc countries in terms of relative performance going forward as well?
Yes, absolutely. The only negative they have right now is that they have been losing a certain amount of their population to other EU countries looking for jobs, because unemployment does run a little bit high right now. But the economists in that area feel that's transitionally and will turn around soon. But the economy itself is thriving. It's a very service-oriented economy. But the population itself very highly educated, very technical, and they love to tell you that, you know, well, Skype came from Estonia, so they hold this up as an example of their technological advancements. So yes, as a long-term investment, I think the Baltics are fabulous.
Well, that's obviously very encouraging. And as you say, they've already actually delivered an excellent longer-term performance. But just to reiterate the point about market size, as with all frontier markets, $4 billion total market cap. What size is your fund?
Right now, we're about $1 million. We only just launched it not very long ago. But the total that this fund can be would be about $30 million. It would be the max because otherwise we'd own the market and we'd actually cause problems. I mean, we had this when we did one trade of $500,000. We kind of rocked the market a little bit, so we had to be a little careful when you invest in those sort of markets. But about $30 million would be the maximum we could grow this to.
And so there's still plenty of room available. And as you say, that point about market size and liquidity applies to every frontier market. It is this does need, just to reiterate the point you made, to be a long-term investment. There's no sense in saying, oh, we're up 15% this year, let's take our money out, because it's likely to be counterproductive.
Yes, because of liquidity issues. As with any frontier market, it cannot be looked at. And, you know, once they become an emerging market, when they step up, I mean, when then liquidity issues go down. But as it stands right now, especially at the bottom, when you're talking about, say, the top two investments in the index, which are Thalanik, which is a ferry service, actually, believe it or not, and Olympic, which is a gambling casinos. There are plenty of them there. You know, when you get down to the lower companies, there are issues there. As far as liquidity is concerned, yes, definitely.
Okay. Well, with that caveat, thank you very much indeed, Peter. That's been fascinating. And I don't think the Baltics were on many people's radar screen, but that's one of the things we're trying to do with this program, is to actually bring interesting investment opportunities to people's attention. And obviously, with that excellent longer-term track record and the potential that you mentioned, it should be an area that people do look at.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Well, thank you for having
me. Not at all. Hope we can have you back and see how things are going in the not-too-distant future.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. That was Peter Curley, CEO of DMS Funds, on the line from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, with the Baltic Index Fund. The Baltic Benchmark Fund. And as he mentioned, it's a very small market, $4 billion total market cap. The fund itself is relatively new, only $1 million in fund size. But Peter felt that they could invest up to $30 million, and you just need to have the long-term view on markets of this size, because as with any other frontier market, the Baltics are markets where you can get some money in, although that may take a little while, but trying to get it out in any sort of short time scale can prove difficult. That's just a fact of life in frontier markets. We have a break coming up. Before we do get to the break, if you are watching the news recently, you'll have seen the Syrian Peace Conference in Montreux, just down the road from the World Economic Forum in Davos, so all the foreign ministers can attend. But obviously the civil war in Syria continues. There's issues in Libya. We have the army and former President Morsi and the Islamic Brotherhood in Egypt. It might seem that the entire Middle East is in a state of turmoil. However, that's not the case in terms of investment. Some areas are quite solid. If you're interested in investing in the Middle East, please look at our new publication, the FMI newsletter, our launch edition, which is out in the next 10 days. We have an article on why the Middle East should not be excluded from your investment horizon. The first edition is free. Please write to us at info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca, 888-287-8229. When I come back for the break, I will go to Dubai for another look at the implications of Dubai's win for the Expo 2020 World Trade Fair. For that, I'll be talking to an important contributor to the first of our two books on frontier markets. Please stay with me for that.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Last November, Dubai, one of the United Arab Emirates, won the nomination to host the 2020 World Expo. It reportedly got 116 out of the 167 votes and beat out other finalists, including Ekaterinburg in Russia, Izmir in Turkey, and Sao Paulo in Brazil. Of course, the 2020 Expo comes 2 years before the World Cup in Qatar, so there'll be two major events taking place in the Gulf within a couple of years of each other, which might be good or bad news in terms of infrastructure and the ability to get things developed. To have a look at some of the implications of this decision, I have journalist Mark Townsend online from Dubai. Mark has covered the Middle East for 15 years, reporting for a number of publications, including Al Jazeera, Euromoney, the Financial Times, and Thomson Reuters, and was an important contributor to our first book, Investing in Frontier Markets. Welcome back to the program, Mark.
Good to be with you, Gavin.
Thanks. In a recent Euromoney article, you suggested behind the euphoria over Dubai's success in Expo 2020, there might be some hard numbers that have to be taken into account. Could you enlighten us on that?
They are hard numbers, Gavin, I think. Some very interesting recent figures from the Institute of International Finance in Washington, no less, estimated that at the end of 2013, Dubai was sitting atop $144.5 billion debt pile, which is roughly just slightly over 100% of its GDP. And the IIF forecast that figure to rise quite steeply, I think, to $168.5 billion by 2020 in the wake of the Expo win. And, you know, that it expects the GDP ratio to debt to fall to around 70%. But the IIF nevertheless says that anything in, over 70% debt ratio to GDP is very high indeed. I think also this year, 2014, Dubai faces a fairly crucial hurdle when around $22 billion of sovereign debt falls due in the form of maturing bonds to Abu Dhabi. You may remember, Gavin, that Abu Dhabi came to the rescue somewhat at the 11th hour in 2009. So that's due for repayment, alongside around about $8 billion of GRE debt, government-related entity debt. Put that into context, Gavin. That's around a very similar amount of sovereign debt repayment of the Spanish government this year in 2014. So pretty big numbers, I think, Gavin.
Indeed. And obviously that was the aftermath of the bust in the Dubai property market when, as you say, fellow United Arab Emirate Abu Dhabi came to the rescue eventually. To what extent has Dubai managed to stabilize its economy? It does seem as though the property market's picked up somewhat. Obviously, the Expo win was regarded as good news, and the stock market responded quite favorably to that. Has it put the legacy of its bust behind it?
Well, certainly, if we measure that and judge that on the, in terms of sentiment amongst institutional investors seems to be very positive at the moment. A number of analysts I spoke to, including EFG Hermes, saying they expect a few difficulties with debt this year, and the biggest maturities we mentioned earlier on, the $20 billion due to the UAE Central Bank and Abu Dhabi own institutions, they expect it to be rolled over. That's a point echoed by Credit Suisse. They think Dubai's strong economic performance will help positive sentiment and overall excess liquidity in global markets. Points to it being well received. And so far, Dubai's paid off liabilities as they have become due. There's been no real major issues. The restructuring has taken a little bit more time, I think, than people anticipated. And in fact, last year, the US dollar bond issuances by the Dubai government were received very well and were heavily oversubscribed. The last time I looked at credit default swaps, they were around about 215 basis points, which is, roughly half of what they reached a few years ago. So, but sustaining that confidence is key. And I think that to the extent of what, the debt is restructured or rolled over could affect, sentiment ahead of the $25 billion first tranche of Dubai World's first repayment in 2015, Gavin.
So there's more... effectively, that's the best part of 50, 55 billion due in the next couple of years, which is obviously, as you say, a large amount in absolute terms and in relation to the size of the economy. In terms of the actual spending that Dubai is going to need to do, having won the World Expo, do we have any estimate in terms of costs and where that spending is going to be going?
Well, in fact, Standard Chartered produced a report subsequent to the Expo Award, Gavin, and it was very bullish, in fact, and they're estimating that the bill for the Expo will be about $9 billion, which is 8 or 9% of GDP, and they're saying the costs look manageable relatively to the size of Dubai's economy. And then the figures of just to go back to what you were mentioning. The IMF estimates that between 2014 and 2016, there's around $64 billion of debt due for repayment. But I think that I was quite surprised actually about how bullish these analysts seem to be, and who am I to sort of differ from them as a humble hack? But I do wonder, to what extent that there's a little bit of short termism. We're already starting to see around the peripheries, and very central to that sort of issue, the sort of evidence of overheating in the real estate market. Figures just out, I think, in the last few days, suggesting rises of 22% in the real estate market for villas last year. I mean, come on, I'm sort of got the stopwatch going up, how long it would take for there to be deja vu cliches creeping into the newspapers. But they're expecting up to 25 million people will visit the Expo 2020. That compares to around about 10 million right now. So these are very heady figures. But the main beneficiaries are going to be the infrastructure spending. The real estate market will get another boost, I think. And it all depends, I think, how successfully Dubai manages its debt going forward. And the consensus seems to be that they're handling it relatively well. And that's I think vindicated by what we can see within the market in terms of things like credit default swap figures and so forth, Gavin.
So to finish up here, Mark, then Dubai obviously has done fairly well, especially with the win. Trying to keep expectations realistic for investors? It looks relatively plain sailing, but at the same time, they would need to watch what happens with the debt rollover this year and next to make certain that this isn't just a false dawn.
Yeah, I don't think we're out of the woods yet. I mean, these are very, very major figures. And I think, you know, we've got to set it into the context of what's happening in the broader macroeconomic environment around the world. And if, you know, if sort of credit lines start to dry up a bit, and if Dubai doesn't really start to sort of, you know, divest itself of some major assets to repay debt, and it's just, kicking the proverbial can down the road, we could have a bit of turbulence. But so far, it looks pretty good.
That's great. Thanks very much indeed, Mark. Appreciate your input on the outcome of winning Expo 2020 for Dubai.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Thanks to journalist and editor Mark Townsend, not just for this report, but for his help with our first book, Investing in Frontier Markets, available now from all good English language bookstores and Amazon.com. Now I'm going to talk to an expert who's career runs parallel to the development of emerging markets. Rich Gulo is on the line from Boston, where he now heads the Argyle Companies as a senior portfolio manager at Battery March from 1984 to 90. He helped establish several emerging market funds for institutional investors, especially those investing in Latin America. But he's also an expert on Asia, and it's about an Asian market that we want to talk with him today. Welcome back to the program, Rich.
Thank you, Gavin, and this looks like it's going to be another very interesting investment year for frontier and emerging markets.
It certainly does, and obviously one of the things that makes it interesting, and hopefully not in the old Chinese curse sense, may you live in interesting times, but the political unrest tends to lead to volatility in markets. Thailand is a market where the government has just declared a state of emergency in Bangkok and surrounding areas to cope with protests that included violent attacks. State of emergency is set to last for at least 60 days. Which sectors are being most affected by the problems in Thailand? Presumably tourism, which is a major driver of the economy, is one of those that's being set back somewhat by the reports we're seeing on the TV news.
Yes, the stocks like Thailand Airport, I've been under some pressure for a while now, as you might expect. Tata Steel, Thailand, which would be both domestic construction and global Asian demand company, is nearly on its all-time low. Some of the bank stocks have suffered. But ironically, many, many stocks there, and we always see this, you as a veteran and me as a veteran who isn't surprised by this. Many domestic companies are doing just fine. And the question would be, would there be a withdrawal of global assets because of fears about currency liquidity crises and so on?
Right. So, I mean, it would be fair to say that Thailand looks as though it could continue being unstable with the standoff between Thaksin Shinawatra's sister as prime minister and the democratic quote-unquote movement who are protesting against her government. Is Thailand essentially a domestic story? It's not like, for example, unrest in China, which would lead to repercussions around emerging and indeed developed market. Essentially, Thailand, what happens in Thailand stays in Thailand, unless, as you say,
Yes. It would take a domino effect with dominoes that we can't see in the fog, if you want to create an image, going off in a direction and hitting something that you don't expect. It would have to be a hedge fund that suddenly had leveraged into Thai bonds that were going to default or some other sovereign element of that sort. I don't think this is a tip of a large iceberg that global investors will have to worry about. But that said, it's also the sort of place where when things sort out, there'll be some fantastic buys.
Absolutely, and you and I can both recall 20 years ago with similar unrest and sort of the army in the streets. You mentioned some of the sectors that have been hit somewhat, things like tourism-related, infrastructure-related, and the banks. The domestic stocks, are there any specifically that you would suggest listeners keep an eye on? Because if they're strong now with the uncertainty, then they presumably will do pretty well when things get better.
Yes, actually, there are more than a few, as is almost always the case. But the Delta Electronics, which provides power supplies for the high tech and communications industry, would be one. So there are Thailand land. Which would be a domestic investment in the local economy would be another. Singer Thailand, although it's had an enormous run into any kind of correction, would be part of the domestic and global apparel industry. I think that you always keep an eye on the local telecom company. In this case, Thaicom has a satellite that probably doesn't have much to do with any domestic distress. And the Thai fund is your timing element. You do your basic fundamental work on the country, and then be adequate.
You buy the country fund when you feel things are more attractive. Absolutely. Thanks very much indeed, Rich. That's very valuable as always. I think one of the most useful things when we speak to you is the fact that you do have stock-specific ideas that are, and especially the ones that maybe are holding up better than people might expect given the uncertainties. Really appreciate the input that you've given us.
Well, thank you very much, Gavin, and I have to admit that I'm happy I'm not going to the Olympics this year. I would have some worries about that, but that's for another day.
It is. All right. Our thanks to Rich Schuller of the Argyle Companies for that analysis of the effect of the disturbances in Thailand. After we come out of the break, we will be talking to advisor coach Jim Reuter on how you as an advisor can help position emerging and frontier market investments for your clients. Thanks very much.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
Do you like what you hear about investing in emerging and frontier markets on this program? Would you like to learn more to increase your investing effectiveness? EFMI Media also publishes a subscription-based newsletter called EFMI. We'd like to tell you more about it. Drop us an email at info@emergingfrontier.ca. We've designed EFMI as a newsletter to provide expert and up-to-date news and analysis of opportunities in the same markets that we discuss here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. EFMI has information and analysis that you won't find anywhere else, and you can start receiving it by emailing info@emergingfrontier.ca.
Get ahead in business and life. Read Getting It Done, 1,000 of the Best-Kept Secrets for Success in Business and Life by John Capozzi. Learn how John, a successful Connecticut businessman, obtained 13 corporate promotions in 13 years. This book makes a fantastic gift for anyone who wants to get ahead in business. Voice America will donate a portion of every copy sold to the USO. Visit GettingItDone.com and enter promo code VA1234 at checkout to get a 10% discount. That's GettingItDone.com, promo code VA1234 for a 10% discount today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. In our final segment, we'll, as I mentioned, be talking to Jim Reuter, who we've spoken to before about some of the ways that advisors can help position emerging and frontier markets as an asset class with their investors. I think it's fairly clear that we believe that they're an attractive area that you want to be in. But first, advisor and client have to sit down for some honest discussion about what kind of emerging and frontier market investment belongs in your portfolio, what instruments should be used, and what weightings and timelines you should consider. Jim is an advisor coach and was a big help in the first of our two books on frontier markets, investing in frontier markets. We're here to talk more about the subject of how you position these interesting assets with your client. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
So an early part of the process is to get comfortable with the advisor before you even start talking about fairly esoteric stuff like emerging and frontier market investments, correct?
Yeah, no question. You know, you have to be really, as an investor, I think, really comfortable at the outset. I think perhaps asking yourself probably two points, really. One is, do I have a sufficiently knowledgeable and experienced advisor that I trust in these markets to help, guide my investment decisions? So, and do I have the right person? And then I think, as equally as important as this, is am I prepared to take that person's advice when investing in these markets? You know, no sense having a guide if you don't pay attention to him or her.
No, that's true enough. So we've already touched on some parts of this ongoing process in our previous conversations, how advisors and clients get moving on emerging markets and frontier markets and making the decisions. Still, the kinds of questions they must deal with perhaps become a little bit more vital in esoteric asset classes, whether it's private equity or venture capital or emerging and frontier market investments. So would it be fair to say there are elements of both? You've got to know your client pretty well as obviously being aware of your own strengths in this area?
Yeah, I think if you're an investor, first of all, if you're an advisor, clearly you've got to know your own strengths. But I think if you're an investor looking at this kind of marketplace, you know, you really have to know thyself is a big part of that. So you've got to know yourself first. And I think this is not always easy because other factors really come into play, like ego, pride, maybe past experiences, that sort of thing. So an investor will do very well to be sure they get the job done properly at first. So make sure you know who you are if you want to go into, like you said, esoteric markets, a little bit different kind of place where it takes a different kind of understanding.
So let's start from the what the individual needs to know about themselves. Presumably an ability to handle volatility has got to be an important part of that if you're going to be investing in emerging and frontier markets.
Yeah, no question. Self-honesty here is something that's really important. You know, it's no sense lying to yourself. I remember a guy years ago I used to play golf with. He used to love lying about his handicap.
Score. Yep.
To his disadvantage. He was about a 20, but he said he was a 10, and he lost money all the time. He was a great
Ouch.
Guy to play, but you don't want to be that way as an investor. You know, this reminds me really of how you plan a long trip, whether with a map or even a GPS. You first have to know where you are today in order to fashion a route to get to where you want to go. So unless you're prepared to be honest with yourself, you might end up places you didn't really want to be. So it's the same with investing, and especially in the rarefied air, I think, of emerging and frontier markets. An investor has to be aware of their situation and what their reality really is in order to make the right decisions about that market and entry into it. Look, you know, in many ways, there really are no truly bad investor markets, but there are bad fits of investors with markets. And, you know, if you're an investor, if you're an advisor, you want a good fit.
Absolutely. Presumably one of those being, is my portfolio sufficiently diversified so that possible losses in one market were not going to affect me too badly? Having a large enough portfolio to make it sensible to put something like this in the first place presumably would be a couple of those questions you'd need to answer.
I think those are questions you want to ask yourself. You want to ask your advisor. I think there's a couple other things you probably look at. One is, do wild price swings affect my mood poorly? Do you really react poorly to potential or impending market losses and then maybe crystallize them rather than ride them out? You know, can you compartmentalize this investment? Kind of goes to an earlier point you were making, so it doesn't affect your life or lifestyle. If this is money you're playing with, you know, can you stomach the total loss of the investment if that were to happen? You know, to reframe the paradigm in many ways is like risk and loss versus risk reward. Because I think in the risk reward thing, we think, well, the greater the risk, the greater the reward necessarily. And of course, that's not true. So, yeah, these are the kinds of questions you really have to work with. And I think, finally, do you know enough about these markets to be a good client and an investor if you are an investor? An intelligent client is the best client and the best investor, too. So as Zig Ziglar used to say, you know, you need to give yourself a checkup from the neck up just to see how this whole thing works with you. A lack of knowledge will necessarily make you more skittish and prone to, silly investor behavior, and that never helps.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things we're trying to do here on Emerging and Frontier Market Investing is to help educate investors and obviously advisors about these markets so that they're hopefully able to make better informed decisions. Jim, thanks very much, as always, for your insight on that. It really is important, I think, for people to be honest with themselves when they're looking at investing in investment classes like emerging and frontier markets that they're not as familiar with.
Yeah, amen. It's not bad, just different, and you got to know what's going on.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
All right, my friend. Bye-bye.
Bye. Our thanks to advisor coach Jim Ruta on the line from Burlington, Ontario, where apparently it's minus 23. The polar vortex is in full grip again. But it's very important to be aware of what type of investor you are and your tolerance for risks and the how emerging frontier markets investments would fit into your portfolio. Just before I wrap up the program, obviously we here at Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing believe that the radio is important for conveying important information to you, the listener, but there's only so much we can do in an hour. That's why we're starting newsletter, the EFMI newsletter, which obviously is short for Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing. We'd like to send you the free introductory edition, which will hopefully increase your comfort level and certainly increase your knowledge. Please write to us at info@emergingfrontier.ca or call 888-287-8229. Next week, here on Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing, we'll have Baldwin Burgess from Silk Invest on the line from London for a look at Africa. From Toronto, a demographic consultant and researcher, Peter Merrick, will have another look at some frontier markets. And from New York, I'll have Chelare Samek of Carvel Management. You may have heard or read his analysis of frontier markets on Bloomberg, and I'll ask him to flesh out that perspective. I'm Gavin Graham. Our producer is Al Emid. We are the co-authors of Investing in Frontier Markets, now available in English-speaking markets, and Frontier Markets for Dummies, coming to bookstores very soon. We're also the publishers of the FMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks. Please join us again next week.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.